Annie Contrelli interviewing Rudy Audio on July 9th, 1991. And Rudy, or Rudy, why don't you go ahead and tell me what your tie was with the university and some of the years that you were at the university and just kind of leave this.
Okay. Well, my name, my official name is Arnie Rudolph Audio, but I've always been called Rudy. So even my grandchildren call me Rudy, so I guess it's stuck. But anyway, I came to the university, I think it was in the fall of 1957, and then I retired from the university in 1984. And I did return for one more quarter, thinking that I was going to teach part-time in my retirement, but I felt after the final teaching quarter, the fall quarter '84, that I decided to quit teaching altogether, launch a new career, and now I'm full-time therapist right now, potter and artist, whatever you want to call it. So that I've more than compensated for my retirement. I have gone into almost a second profession now with a very active professional life in my field of art.
Getting back to your experiences at the university, why don't you tell me a little bit about what kinds of courses you taught and just more about your experience?
Okay. Well, Annie, this is, actually, I think I ought to go back a little bit further than that. Just to develop my background before coming to the university, I had been at the Archie Gray Foundation in Helena for about 5 years as a resident artist and director of the Brays. In that context, I had met the university president, Carl McFarland, who used to come to the Bray Foundation and visit with us and look at the pottery objects and things that we used to make in those days. And also, I was very active in doing architectural ceramics for public buildings around the state. After I'd been there for about 5 years, I went to the State Historical Society, and I worked with Ross Toole, who was then director of the State Historical Society, and almost on a part-time basis, I worked there as an artist doing museum exhibits. And I further strengthened my contact with Carl McFarland in that connection, because Ross and Carl were quite good friends. And then it developed that there was some opening in the art program over here at the university, and Carl McFarland asked me if I would care to join the university faculty. And so I did, and that was the way I came to the university. I might add that Carl McFarland was a kind of an authoritarian type of president who hired me over the heads of the art faculty. And I wasn't really very popular with them at first, but then after a while, they accepted me in the fold, and I guess my performance was okay. So I became a fully accepted member of the faculty at the university. But the manner of hiring was a little bit unusual, because even in those years, it was customary at least to advise the faculty that someone was being hired. But Carl McFarland didn't do things that way. You know. I think that he was unpopular in some quarters for doing things directly. At any event, I joined the faculty. Walter Hook was head, and Aidan Arnold had been here for many years. He was sort of the retired chairman. James Dew was here, and I believe there were two young faculty hired there, myself and Rudy Turk, to teach art history. Rudy Turk has since then left and has had a very outstanding career, recently retiring at the Arizona State University, where he has been the director of the museum there. A beautiful $19 million building has been built there under his tenure, and I just recently saw him again. But Rudy and I were freshman teachers in 1957. Well, my principal project was to set up a ceramics program at the university, which I proceeded to do, and they set up a shop for me, which was, in those years, it was a barracks building. I think it was originally a Spanish-American barracks building from the Spanish-American War. It even predated the World War I, an old decrepit building that housed the skating rink machinery. It's no longer on campus, but it ran parallel to the south end of the swimming pool. And at that time, the present ceramics facilities were housed in the skating rink. It was a hockey rink, which didn't function. And so some years later, I persuaded the administration to make it into an art building. And the legislature was, certain people in the legislature came over and looked at the sad conditions of the barracks building. And they thought that, well, yeah, this guy needs a decent place to work. But more about that later, and that happened during the making of the Grizzly Bear. And but nevertheless, we had a very good program going in the ceramics building there at the old barracks building. And we're very, in spite of the fact that it was very crowded and the floors were breaking through, we had a lot of very good students who came through the program, and many of which have gone into very distinguished careers of their own in ceramic art. So that period took about 10 years before we moved into the new hockey rink area, and since then there's been a different environment for ceramics ever since. Well, because the expanded quarters, much nicer building, space, light, good kill space, good working space for students, made a great deal of difference. We were also able to get a large sculpture area. You see, when I was teaching here, I was attending to both areas. I was teaching sculpture and as well as ceramics. So there were two areas that I was in responsible charge of. Not to mention, of course, many of the other foundation art courses and art education courses and areas like that I also taught when I was a beginning teacher here. It seemed that as the years rolled on, my focus became more and more concentrated in three-dimensional arts such as sculpture and ceramics.
Now, one of the things that I would be interested in hearing about too is just some of the changes that you observed over the years that you were there as a teacher. You know, changes in the campus, in the administration, in the students.
Mm-hmm.
Feedback on what
Of course, the significant changes that I saw from my perspective all happened, of course, in the art program, but also I look back at some of the really important people on campus. And when I first arrived here, it seemed as though Leslie Fiedler in the English department was a very dominant force, and rightly so. He was a brilliant speaker and a brilliant lecturer. And at that time, my friend Rudy Turk had to work in connection with the humanities program, which had been set up by Leslie Fiedler. And Rudy Turk's job was to lecture in the arts. And this, the humanities program, as it was set up by Leslie, was a development of culture, literature, the arts, and music, and so on, as it went from ancient to present time. So Rudy Turk's job was to lecture on the arts, being an art historian. And he used to go through terrible stress every time he had the lecture because Leslie Fiedler was such a powerful and also quite a critical person who wanted the best for the program. And understandably, Rudy Turk was very nervous about having to conduct these lectures under the critical eye of Leslie Fiedler. Well, after Leslie left the campus, there were many reasons for it. It was a hostile Western frontier culture here for Leslie. In spite of the fact that he'd been here for about 17 years, the time I arrived, I don't think he ever was quite comfortable being here. And that was sad because he was such a brilliant man, and I know that he gave a lot to the university during the years that he was here. But there was a great deal of criticism of Leslie, the hostility against the Jewish intellectual, that kind of thing, that caused him a great deal of distress. And ultimately, he went to teach at in New York. And I think he just recently retired. Following Leslie Fiedler, influence on the campus, then we saw the emergence of a wonderful creative writing department that began to develop under Dick Hugo, the poet. And so even though we lost one thing in Leslie Fiedler, we gained another one. And the influence of Dick Hugo and the creative writing program under his direction, and many people that have been attracted to it since, like Bill Kindrich and many, many good writers, Welch and others who have been here in that kind of creative writing period, I think, has been tremendously significant for the university. Has attracted writers from all over the country, the world, you might say, and has made Missoula a very significant area for writers and poetry particularly. So that being one influence that I think was very marked and very important, what was happening in the English department. I think another one, as far as I was concerned, another important influence was the arrival of Ross Toole on campus. Ross Toole, to me, was a tremendous, wonderful, exciting time because Ross was such a wonderful lecturer, and he could, people would actually applaud him after his lectures. There were thousands of people that would go to his lectures, as many as 1,000, I believe, in the theater, and they would give him standing ovations. He had a great delivery and a wonderful style. And his lectures on Montana history, I think, are memorable. Even today, I still have some of Ross's tapes. But I think the interesting thing about Ross was the fact that his career as a Montanan could have, as a Montanan, was very important. He began as the State Historical Society Director in Helena, where I first got to know him. And life was very, very interesting when Ross Toole was director of the department. His free martini luncheons and things like that would come back to the Historical Society, where he'd get very expansive and talk about all the wonderful things that were going to happen to the art department, or to the art section of the Historical Society. And many of them did materialize. For example, the exhibits and things like that, where I was directly involved in. We had a very popular frontier exhibit created by artists like myself and Shorty Shope and Gardell Christensen and several others that worked with Ross Toole in North Pier. Also, the Montana magazine was established under his direction. Yeah, and then following Ross Toole's career a little further, he became director of the museum, the City Museum in New York, where he stayed for a couple of years in New York City. Then he went to the Santa Fe Museum, and ultimately, after a short period of unsuccessful ranching, he came to the University of Montana and became a singular force that he was in his department, as far as the university was concerned. Then, of course, he was here many years, influenced students, and I think was central to the great deal of interest that people have in preserving Montana. He was very outspoken about the rape of the land, especially in eastern Montana, by the coal interest. And I think he created a consciousness that is probably central to what's happening up here at the university, our environmental programs and everything like that. But then we'll have to look at another influence that I think is even perhaps more important in another way, and that was the tenure of Clancy Gordon, who was a botanist and biologist, the zoologist on our campus. I didn't know Clancy all that well, but I knew him well enough, occasionally talking with him where he had a cabin on Wild Horse Island on Planet Lake, not too far from my cabin on Planet Lake. He had he was one of the first true environmentalists, I think, that our state has ever had. That's not to say that, Bob Marshall and some of the great wilderness heroes of the past haven't been important. But Clancy Gordon came along at a time when we were simply beginning to forget our values here. And he created a consciousness, I think, that also was tremendously important. And he would dramatize these things. For example, he'd climb up on the mountain with his 10 environmental laws, dressed like Moses. And the people just loved it. Of course, it's great publicity. Thou shalt not corrupt our streams, thou shalt not pollute our atmosphere, things like that. Those weren't precise, but something like that. And he was also a consultant by the emerging environmental groups of that time to speak against the wholesale rape of the land that would have been possible in a much larger measure if Clancy Gordon hadn't, spoken against it. And I think he was hated by the coal interests and the oil interests and the forestry interests or the timber interests, everybody else who had stakes in taking from the land and not putting anything back. I'm not saying that all of these groups are that way, but Clancy Gordon at least injected a little bit of conscience into their business operations. And when, of course, all these people are gone now, but I think that those in my lifetime have been some of the more important people. As far as the tenure of the administration's leaders, our administrative leaders here are concerned, I think that we have had a number of good presidents here. I think that it's kind of a thankless job. But I think that perhaps the most significant presidents under whom I served was Carl McFarland, who had somewhat authoritarian kind of leadership. And then the second best leader, I think, was Bob Panzer, who was here in the 70s.
Why were each of those presidents so significant?
Well, I think Carl McFarland was interesting because he had a great deal to do with the building of the university. I think he was very persuasive with the legislature. I think he had a lot of power in a lot of ways. I was a young teacher then, and I wasn't all that aware of it, except that Carl had a very effective and a wise and effective way of working with people, even though I didn't realize it quite at that time. It's much later I felt that Carl had a way of getting things done. And I think Panzer, when he came here as a president, he was not only effective with the legislature, it's my sense that he was, but he was very close to the tenor of the times with the student uprising, Vietnam conflict, and all of that. He was very wise in the way he handled all of that. It was a very explosive time on campus, but it was a time of change, and he understood that, and still he functioned and made this university run well, I think. So they stand out for me.
During those times of uprising and changes, what were some of the changes that you noticed in the students, and just maybe the attitude that some of the students had and some of the attitudes on campus?
Well, compared to the, I think that there was a big, in those years, the Vietnam years, there was a great deal of hostility toward government and the administration, including all kinds of authority, I felt. It was a time to question authority, no matter what it was, whether it was university authority, whether it was the teacher in the classroom, whether it was the policies of the United States government in Asia or abroad. It sort of caught on like wildfire. And it seemed to happen somewhere in the early 60s on campus. I think as early as possibly 63, 64, there were rumblings of dissent. The My Lai massacre in Vietnam, for example, I think started to crystallize a lot of doubt about what were we doing over there. And then, in the middle 60s, the student marches downtown began to happen, where we'd start up on campus and we'd march through town. And there was a lot of hostility, because the U.S. could do no wrong. And so some of those early marches were, there may have been about 50 of us marching in these so-called protest parades. We were pelted by eggs, and we were called communists and pinkos and everything like that. But interestingly enough, the following year, the size of the parade was almost three or four times what the first one was. And then finally, In the 70s, those were huge demonstrations.
And they were made up of both students and faculty.
Students and faculty and townspeople, mm-hmm. and everybody began to join these, that it was a very, very clear message as to how people stood. There were a few dissenters. People on the streets were not nearly as hostile or as violent. And I can remember where people in black clothes and small neckties were taking pictures of all of us marching, you know, with Canada, the FBI, and people outrightly investigating, taking pictures of all of us who were marching. It was that kind of a time.
Were there any repercussions that you felt from being involved?
The only ones, name doesn't come to me, but in the botany and the biology department, I can't remember. But he traveled to Vietnam, and he was a very outspoken critic of the war. I can't think of his name right now. Oh, I know it very well. It's just I'm blocking. But he was. I think they were tapping his phone. They were accusing him of all kinds of communist sympathizers. All kinds of terrible things, unjustly so. And he demonstrated scientifically how, years later, of how defoliation was affecting the health of children and all of the people in that area that were devastated by the war in the first place. But for us to have done such a heinous crime of defoliating their crops and dropping herbicide on everything they had over there. It took a great deal of courage on his part to do this. Yeah. He's still around campus. He's retired now. He was very well known. Yeah.
We'll probably remember it.
Yeah.
Okay. Later.
But anyway, those were the times in the 60s and early 70s. Students were much more demonstrative, and I think also they were a little bit irresponsible in terms of what the administration had to contend with. In my own shop, running a ceramics department was almost impossible because in some ways I represented authority and everything was ripped off constantly. Every time I put stuff together, I'd get some good things for the students to use, they'd steal it or it was taken. There was kind of a destructive attitude.
Later on?
No, during that time.
During the Vietnam.
Yeah, I think it was frustration in students being expressed in all kinds of slightly hostile ways, like rip off the administration, you know, that who needs this tool, you know. And I'd set up my shop and I'd have tools there for students to use, but they'd all disappear. Or my little bathroom, or my scales that I used to weigh ceramics on, those would disappear. I could buy 10 of those a year because people were starting to smoke pot in those years, you know. And so they'd weigh it out, I suppose. My gram scales were constantly missing. I couldn't keep a pair of gram scales in the place. Even though I locked it down and everything, they were very ingenious about ripping me off. I won't say that. I think it's probably a few bad apples that were doing that. I don't think that the students that in general did it, but there was an attitude of frustration with administration and all forms of authority. And later, late 70s and through the early 80s, when I was still teaching there, I noticed a much more docile student who demanded answers to questions. They wanted to know more about a lot of things. They wanted me to give them facts. They wanted to prepare their lives to make a living. We were dealing with a slightly different kind of student later on. Attitudes changed. They'd been molded somehow. They were tired of war. They were tired of fighting, I guess. Or maybe it was filtered down through attitudes of parents and people of influence. We were tired of Vietnam. We wanted to put that in the background. We were tired of Watergate. We were tired of a lot of things. We wanted things to be normal. We desperately wanted things to be normal, I think.
that was a prevalent attitude
around
the world.
Yeah, right.
Well, what, just as far as, well, I guess probably I'll make it more generic so you can think of specifics within your own realm of experience, but tell me about some of your more significant memories of the university, whether it's in the context of teaching, or maybe this would be a good opportunity for you to tell me about the process of creating your grizzly bear in the Oval, you know, just some of those highlights.
Okay, well, yes, I came to the university, even though I had had teacher training, I've never really believed in the so-called education school propaganda and their method of teaching. I had an inward resentment of that kind of teaching program, or that they recommend. Oh, I believed in lesson plans and long-range goals and things like that up to a certain point, but I felt that if I came here to teach, I wanted to give the students what I understood to be important attitudes. And I think it worked. I was a professional in the sense that I had made my living as an artist before I came here, which I'm doing again, in a way. But I would do things like I'd do architectural ceramics. That was my principal activity, making ceramics for public buildings in the state of Montana, churches and schools and banks and places that would commission me to do sculpture or artwork for them. And when I arrived here, I still had a commission. I had carried a commission over from Helena, which I had to execute somewhere. So I set up shop as though I was actually going to make something important, you know. And I had students watch me. I hired student assistants, and they actually literally helped me make this piece. And they learned a lot. And I think they were motivated because they saw that by so doing, one could actually maybe make a living at doing this kind of art. So I felt as long as I could do it, as long as I had the energy to do it, I would always work in the classroom. I'd always make art for sculpture in the classroom, and the students would see that I had just as many failures as I had successes. So they learn by seeing me do things, by succeeding and failing, which is an important lesson for art people to learn, I think. Or any other field, I suppose. It's much easier for an artist in an art program to do that. I realize it would be more difficult for a historian or a teacher of English to do similar kinds of things, to actually work in a classroom situation. But the studio teaching situation permits that, and I think it works. On the other hand, if you have a studio situation and the artist teacher does not work in class, the students always have a seed of doubt as to whether or not this person is truly capable of teaching. You get some very bright kids who come into an art program who draw like wizards, and, you know, they have basic art talent that is outstanding, but many of them can't sustain. And so there are a lot of little lessons that you have to get across to them, and I think that was an important teaching experience. That was a successful teaching method I had, and it had very little to do with what I learned in art education. Well, then there are other highlights. Other highlights are kind of funny, like making the grizzly bear for the campus. Now that's become a very important thing on campus. And I'm half amused and half chuckled to myself when I recall the days how that happened. For one thing, we were being crowded out of the barracks building. It was just too much. I had huge classes in a space no larger than this studio of 20 by 40 feet. And it was terribly difficult to teach there. And so the story behind the making of the Grizzly Bear was also a ploy to get better space. And I'll tell you how this happened. One time we were on a fundraising tour down in San Francisco under Bob Panzer was assistant president there, his academic vice president. And he and I got drunk on top of the Hotel Ritz-Carlton one day, and in our cups we started to say things like, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could build a campus mascot on? And so I said, yeah, that would be wonderful, Bob, why don't we do this? And so the Grizzly Bear Project was born. And I never realized what I got into, because I'm not a wildlife artist. I didn't even know what a grizzly bear looked like, except pictures. And so I started this year-long project of making this grizzly bear, and it took a great deal of my life. I started to make studies, and all of these bears, some of them look like monkeys, some of them look like dogs. And so I went down to the Kansas City Zoo, and I saw some real grizzly bears. You know, I'm not going to go up in the wilds with Jonkel and find real grizzly bears. Am I crazy? So I went to the zoo to look at these bears, and you can't believe the odd assortment of bears I saw there. Some were skinny, some were fat, some didn't have any fur, some had strange heads, others had small, gnarled feet, and, you know, they're just as individualistic as a bunch of people. You know, some might have been dwarves, for all I knew. So I could never nail down what a grizzly bear looked like. I took photographs, I studied it, and you know, it takes a longer time than a year to know how to become a wildlife artist. I discovered that because when I had this studio space filled with models of grizzly bears, you know, most of them were little models of different sizes, and I invited the faculty to come up here to look at these things, it looked like some sort of an animal cage. It was just the most ridiculous thing you ever saw. Finally, who was the chemistry professor who was part of that committee came up and looked at it? And Bob Panzer and several others, I think. Again, vice president, wonderful man. Landini came up, I think. They all had this puzzled look on their face, but we finally centered on one that looked like it had some promise.
Among the many models
I had around here. Of course, you realize my career as an artist had stopped doing this thing for about a year and a half. And I made this huge model and just made it right in here in this part of the space. And actually, it turned out fairly well. And the people from the physical plant came here, and they boxed it up and sent it to San Francisco to the art foundry down there, and they did a wonderful job of casting it. And an appropriate and fitting end to the story is that the grizzly bear, the finished bronze, was sent by beer truck from San Francisco to the campus and erected in place. It didn't cost anything to build this except what the students managed to put together. Pacific Hide and Fur donated some money. The Burlington Northern gave us some bronze. And so I think there were costs of something like $11,000 to make this thing. Those were the actual foundry costs. And then it cost the campus development committee or some other committee about $17,000 to build the footing or the stand on which it stands. So it's been fun. I see it on postcards. I see it on t-shirts. and the grizzly bear is on, a lot of different things.
But
it's not a work of art. It's not to be confused with a work of art. I think that,
why do you say that?
It's not an art piece.
Why?
I think that under the general heading of curiosities, you would put the grizzly bear importantly as a curiosity, as a campus curiosity. Sort of belongs in the Smithsonian under things you'd put into an attic or something, but it's too large to put into an attic.
Do you have any regrets about doing it?
Well, you know, if I had had a little more time, and if I could have truly gotten interested in the project as an art project, I think it could have developed into something. But as an art piece, it doesn't quite make the mark.
I'm sure there are a lot of people who would disagree with you.
There were a lot of people who loved it. Yeah. But in my heart, you know, I knew it wasn't a work of art. So that's why I could never quite face it.
Now, what year was it actually erected?
It was erected in 1969, and I had started on it, I think, late in 67, I believe it was. I just can't remember.
So it took a lot more of the time just doing the research on the actual form.
Right. It took a long time. The funny stories. Tony Cronin was a visiting poet on campus at the time, and we used to come up here and finish off some beers after we closed Eddie's Club, and he'd say things about my grizzly bear models that were unprintable. but we had a good time making it, I guess.
Well, why don't you tell me a little bit more about what kinds of campus activities you were involved with, or some kind of organizations and some of those significant
Well,
things.
To tell you the truth, I really wasn't involved with much committee work. I think they stopped asking me to serve on committees because I was so inattentive. I'd pass that on to any young faculty person who doesn't want to serve on campus committees to fall asleep or to not pay attention, always come unprepared. And eventually they won't ask you. And that was the story of my life.
So that's the key, huh?
My first campus committee was Campus Development Committee. And I had been gathering wool throughout all of these meetings, and the chairman of the committee looked at me when I finally volunteered to say something. And there was a stunned silence in the committee as they looked at me. And he said, "Mr. Audio, that's what we've been talking about for the last 2 days." So I hadn't paid any attention then. So they never asked me back. I thought that was good.
Oh, dear. If you had the chance to go back in time, what would you do differently, or what memory or experience do you think you would want to relive?
On campus.
Well,
I think some of the proudest times were in the early 70s, I think, when we really had a good program in ceramics growing. I think that I was very close to the program in ceramics, and we began to see a real professionalism develop there with the addition of very talented young faculty who joined me, like Ken Little, who's no longer with us, and Dennis Voss, who went to Ranchi, and a sculptor named Ted Waddell, who was with us for a while. They brought a lot of wonderful energy to the campus and to the program. I'm not sure if you want me to be this specific, but this was to the art program. And along with that, interestingly enough, for the first time we had a great deal of conflict in our department. A lot of petty politics. That to me is the saddest thing about university teaching, is that that there is a lot of unnecessary conflict in various departments. We had it especially in our art department. And I heard an interesting analysis of this. One of my friends said, the reason we fight so much in the art department is because the stakes are so small. And you know, that's true. That there's a lot of little things like territorialism and empire building and that kind of thing that, you know, people get accused of falsely, perhaps. Many of them are just doing their jobs, and petty jealousies develop, and things like that happen. I wish that weren't true, because so much energy goes into, you know, the conflict side of university life, and I just wish that there was a solution to that problem.
What are some of the things that you enjoyed about the university?
The university, well, of course, the very high level of cultural and intellectual activity that's there, almost constantly. Any week you'll find a fine speaker or a fine artist that comes on the campus, music, in the science fields, in any field you imagine. Just look at the calendar, you know, it's just so full. One couldn't possibly absorb it all, but it's always there, and I think that it's like a heartbeat of importance on the campus, that there's always something good happening there. If you want to take advantage of it, it's there. I'd like just to sort of, in conclusion, mention some of the very outstanding faculty and the experiences I've had with them, because I think it might have some bearing on an oral history. And my thoughts concerning Walter Hook, for example, who was the chair of our department, had an important influence on my outlook on things. Walter, of course, comes from Finnish background just like I do, and so we had this kind of a common background, and also a kind of a common development, or a development that wasn't common. That is, he became a painter, but I became an artist in clay, and I had to admire Walter Hook a great deal because of his versatility as a painter, and he had a very versatile kind of outlook and interest in painting, ceramics and architecture and a lot of things. But he was most effective, I think. I spoke earlier of the need for art teachers to actually be on top of problems in a studio classroom situation. And Walter was another person who would always work in a studio situation. He'd sit up there and paint or draw and show the students how things work, and acquired a great deal of respect as a result of that. And I'm not sure if he wasn't the first one to do that, but anyway, we shared that idea in common. Walter Hook became one of the outstanding watercolorists of our time, and he was in many, many watercolor shows throughout the country and won top awards. And he was a wonderful teacher and had a great deal of influence. People who have passed on, like Aidan Arnold. Aidan Arnold was a painter. I wasn't particularly popular with Aidan because I was hired over his head, that is, as I mentioned earlier. But Aidan had a wonderful background, having worked with many painters like Thomas Hart Benton of Kansas. Great Midwest landscape and what would you call him, a genre painter. And Aidan Arnold was prominent in the 40s, but he was a gentleman from head to toe, and he was just a great, wonderful man. He was always a gentleman, always wore a tie, and who was neatly dressed and gave the image of what a professor ought to look like and gave the department some class. And he was a good teacher and an excellent draftsman. And when he taught drawing classes, people learned how to relate to the old Beaux Arts technique of drawing, which I'm afraid in many cases is lost today. It's partially recaptured by the energy of Don Bunsey, who's been the principal drawing teacher on campus for many years. And Don is also a printmaker of the First Order, whose distinction of having invented the collagraph, as being one of the inventors of the collagraph, is a little known fact, but it's an important printmaking medium. Don has been on campus now, I think, for more than 25 years in the art program. Prior to him and succeeding Rudy Turk, our historian, was an artist, painter, art historian named Jim Leedy, who has since then gone on to receive national attention as a painter and sculptor, and now teaches at the Kansas City Art Institute. There have been a few other people throughout the years, like, as for example, Jim Dew, who's always been a stalwart in the department, and later on, Jim Todd, who joined us from the philosophy department, one of our graduates, but who has now embarked on a career of doing absolutely wonderful wood etchings or wood engravings of campus personalities and writers, and he's certainly been a feather in our cap in the last few years. There have been many people on campus before and since, but those are the ones I think that I esteem them very highly. Also, I should like to mention the importance of some of the secretaries and the people that have been part of our teaching here. And when in the few times where I have served as acting chairman, I found them to be absolutely essential to the functioning of any department. And I remember Sue Seymour particularly, who was our secretary in the late 70s, early 80s, and she was just absolutely superb. I could never have functioned as a chairman without her. And they contribute so much, and they get low pay, but they know more than anybody about the structure and the workings of any program, any department. So I think that they're a largely unsung group that deserve much, much credit for what they've done and the cement that holds this university together. I can't think of much more. I suppose if I'd start to ramble, I'd tell you other things, but I did want to mention some of those faculty, some of those important people that have contributed so much.
Well, thank you very much. If there are any other memories or experiences that you can think of at a later time,
please be sure. Okay, I will. Go ahead.